thank you for speaking with me today about your career. So you have a master's in theoretical physics and a PhD in high energy physics, and then you worked on modeling and designing antennas in the defense and telecommunications industries before becoming a patent attorney.
That's correct, yes.
You are now a patent attorney with Marks and Clerk, and you, one of your specialties is in medical imaging technology.
Yeah. That's right, yes.
So I'm wondering if we go back, do you remember how or when you became interested in science?
You know, the first thing that I wanted to be was a writer. It wasn't a scientist at all. And it's been a really strange path because this has kind of looped me round to doing what I wanted to do when I was 5 years old, although I probably imagined that that writing would be fiction or something else. But instead, I spend my day writing a lot of letters and patent applications. But probably by the time I was 10, I did want to be a scientist, although I didn't really know about any other scientists than the ones who did like pharmaceuticals and worked in a lab and the standard picture of somebody wearing a white coat. Then as I got a bit older, I guess I learned about different sorts of science and got interested in physics as a teenager at high school.
And do you remember, so when you were, say, 10 or 12, you had this idea of people working in pharmaceuticals wearing lab coats. And do you know how you got that idea? Was it something that you just saw that on TV? Or how do you think you had that image?
Probably in books.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
a big reader.
Okay.
But I don't remember any specific person. Don't think I was aware of knowing many people who were scientists, although my parents were both computer programmers, so that's slightly adjacent, I suppose.
It's kind of technical, yeah.
Kind of technical.
At least for me, taking physics in high school, in a class of about 30, there were maybe four girls. Did you have that kind of experience?
Yeah, absolutely. In my final year, there were myself and one other girl in a class of with nine boys at
mm-hmm.
that point. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it was always a bit imbalanced.
And did you find that awkward at all?
It was a little frustrating because the teacher would always match me with that one other girl instead of, you know, normally you'd mix other people around more in terms of who they worked with. So I remember having to say to him, you're doing this, can you do this differently?
But it wasn't an awkward situation. It wasn't challenging to be, or was it challenging, the lopsided balance?
I don't think it was particularly easy. I was quite stubborn at that age about just wanting to do it anyway.
And you went on to St. Andrews, where you got a master's in theoretical physics. And did you decide to go there solely based on the physics department, or were there other factors?
I really had no idea of how to compare physics departments. You know, I had some advice from my teachers, but where I grew up in Paisley in the west of Scotland. It was extremely uncommon for people from my school to go outside the west of Scotland. So I had some advice on what were good universities away from home. At that stage, you didn't have information on the internet. You couldn't go and look at loads and loads of different comparison or advice, or all I had really was the brochure and the open day. I did very much enjoy the open day when I went to St. Andrews, but that may just have been because it was sunny and the beach was really nice and I had an ice cream, and I'm sure the physics department did things to attract me as well, but it wasn't a particularly informed decision.
Where I went to school, you didn't choose your major straight away. But when you started at St. Andrews, did you immediately know you were going to go into physics?
I had applied for joint honours physics and chemistry, but I knew that within the first 2 years I would be able to change, and that was quite appealing for me. Within the first year, I decided that I wasn't also going to continue with chemistry. It wasn't that I particularly disliked or was bad at chemistry. I just realised that if I didn't do chemistry, I got to do more physics, which I was more interested in, and also maths. So I did kind of think within that first couple of years, okay, chemistry went by the wayside in the first year, but then it was, is it going to be physics or combination of physics and maths? And of course, with theoretical physics, that meant it ended up being mostly physics with a good chunk of maths, which was about the right balance for me.
So you talked about going to St. Andrews for the open day and going to the beach, and it was a sunny, wonderful day, and you had this ability to sort of wait 2 years before you had to commit exactly to what you're going to do. But looking back on it now, how would you describe your time there?
In retrospect, I think it was a great decision, actually. I think it was a lucky decision. I hadn't really appreciated that St. Andrews was, at that stage, a reasonably small physics department. My final year physics cohort was about 40 students, and it meant there was quite a lot of communication between students in different years, also with some of the graduate students, but there were good opportunities within what was at the time a reasonably small department, but big enough to have a good range of teaching and a good range of subjects, so I enjoyed it a lot.
So after you finished your master's at St. Andrews, you went on to do a PhD in high energy particle physics at the University of Durham. When you made that decision, or you took that next step, what motivated you to continue?
One thing that I was lucky with in St. Andrews is that St. Andrews has summer internship place at Fermilab every year, and I competed for it and was awarded that summer internship, and that really inspired me with regard to particle physics. It was a really interesting combination of US students and international students from different countries. We were all working on different projects at Fermilab, and we would have regular, like, weekly meetings with the other interns. And I hadn't had any previous experience of research, so that gave me an idea of what researchers actually do all day.
So that experience really motivated you to continue with a PhD?
Yes, it did.
And so looking back on that time when you're doing your PhD, are there some things that stand out for you that you especially enjoyed or that you found especially interesting?
So I was a very strange PhD student in that I really enjoyed writing up. I really enjoyed writing my thesis, and this maybe foreshadows the career that I ended up in finally as a patent attorney, because many of my patent attorney colleagues described the same experience, that they actually enjoyed writing about their research more than they enjoyed doing the research itself. Another thing that I really enjoyed was the community and meeting a lot of other researchers from different groups. You know, when you go to a conference or a summer school and having all this contact with different people doing different things, or even within the department at Durham, we had quite a strong cohort of particle physics researchers and regular seminars and so on. That was something that I really appreciated and still have, you know, in contact with quite a few of those people. I think the way that the PhD is hard has also turned out to be useful for me later on, because many times when I'm faced with something that's really difficult, or especially a paper that's really difficult to understand, or something technical I'm going to have to dig into, I can kind of remember that I did this work in my PhD where there were all these things that I really didn't understand, and I just have to read it and read it again and talk to people and try to draw it out, or whatever other way you'll find to get into that information. I think that's been a skill that I've used in all my subsequent jobs. Just think, well, I don't understand this yet, but I probably have the capability of understanding it. I just have to keep picking away at it in a persistent way.
I find this really interesting because I don't want to say that the topic didn't matter. The topic definitely mattered. But there's also a large process. That was one of the big advantages, the method of learning something where you don't know it and learning how to learn it, learning how to figure it out.
Massively important. Yeah. I have certainly used some of the more concrete skills. I haven't really use the particle physics knowledge specifically later in my career. Obviously, the skills I learned in computer coding were very useful in my direct next steps. And it's still useful for me to know how people go about a coding process, even though I don't do coding anymore. I do talk to people who do that. So the knowledge there was very useful, how to address a mathematical problem in a computational manner. But yes, many of the things that I took away with it were not about the specifics of the subject. They were about how to address a problem, how to communicate with people, how to work collaboratively with people, how to manage my own time and my own way of working. There's certainly things that I started to learn then that I've kind of built on subsequently.
After your PhD, you went on to work on antennas, and it sounds like you were, modelling and designing antennas. Was that a typical career choice from people from the group that you worked in, or how did you decide to do that next?
I realised partway through my PhD that I didn't want to stay in academia. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do next, and I thought that I still wanted to do research. And so I looked into the big employers of physicists, because I thought, well, if I get into one of those and I don't like the exact project I'm doing, I probably have the possibility of moving into a different group internally, or there's probably some flexibility in different routes and career paths that I could take within a larger organisation. So I applied to several large employers of physicists who I thought would appreciate the skills that I gained during my PhD. I got some interviews, I got some offers, and Kinetic seemed a good balance. That's where I ended up working on antenna modelling. They seemed like a good size organisation in a place that I would be prepared to relocate to. That was in Malvern in Worcestershire.
Okay.
Which is very beautiful. Uh-huh. And I often think that if I could just move it up to Scotland, it would be perfect. I still miss it. It's a really lovely place.
I think there were some parts of this work that you enjoyed and some parts that you maybe didn't enjoy as much. I sort of feel like jobs are always a bit of a mixed bag. There's some good and there's some bad in there. And so I'm wondering if you could first describe the part that you enjoyed and then maybe the parts that weren't a good fit for you or the reason that you decided to move on after that.
I did enjoy learning about antennas, about radar initially, and I then later worked on communications antennas. The modelling skills transferred over, and I really enjoyed, I was doing computational electromagnetic modelling with a software called HFSS. I really enjoyed learning that software, and I enjoyed becoming a bit of a local expert as well. However, my enjoyment of learning the antenna aspects and so on was perhaps relatively short-lived. It had a bit of a what next. I thought, I'm just not sure I can see myself doing solely antennas for the rest of my career. When you work in defence, for something to get from concept into actually going into a product is maybe a 10-year timescale or so. So there wasn't that kind of satisfaction of actually producing something. The thing that I was producing was often a report. I found that timescale quite challenging to work with.
Okay, so your next step was you decided to become a trainee patent attorney.
And there was an intervening step.
Oh, was there? I didn't know.
Well, there were two antenna jobs.
Okay.
I was at Kinetic for 6 years, and that was defence context. I wanted to move to Scotland. My partner and I had been kind of asking ourselves why we hadn't bought a house yet, when we clearly could have bought a house, and we realised that the reason that we hadn't bought a house was that we wanted to move back to Scotland eventually. Most of our friends and family were in Scotland, and that became a priority for us to move back.
When you were in Malvern, he was working there as well?
He was working in the patent office in South Wales.
Okay.
So initially, and then he was working in an in-house patent department in Wharton under Edge, which is in Gloucestershire.
Okay.
So here's a bit of a clue as to how I ended up in one of the factors in me ending up in patent. We have always had an explicit principle that there's three factors in where we live. There's how happy I am with my job, how happy he is with his job, and whether we like the actual place. We decided really whoever of us could get a job in Scotland first would go for it, and then the other one would follow.
And so who got the job first?
I did.
Well done!
I think I was more motivated because I was the one who was less happy in my current job. So I got a job working at a company called Andrew Antenna, which is now part of Comscope, and that was in Fife. That was a very different sort of antenna design because it was designing antennas that would actually be made on a much shorter time scale. It was mobile phone base station antennas. That's the long antenna that you'll see on a pole.
So you were working in Fife?
Yes.
And he was working in Edinburgh for this period?
Yes.
Were you living... You were living...
We were living in Dunfermline. Okay. Yeah. We've never had jobs that have actually been in the same town as each other. Mm-hmm. We've always had to commute. The Andrew Antenna job, I thought I would enjoy the fact that it was a lot more practical and shorter timescales and producing things that would actually be used. I didn't really enjoy the more practical aspects, it turned out. I thought I would. I think I thought I would become a more practical person, and actually that really didn't change. The parts of that job that I really enjoyed were learning about things, communicating. So it was more the peripheral parts of the job I was enjoying more than the designing the antennas. When I left, I didn't have a plan of what I was going to do next, so yeah. I was taking a bit of time out to figure out what to do next.
And so how long did that last, this time out?
I ended up with a gap year, but I got the job as a trainee patent attorney. I got that job about 5 months in. Mm-hmm. It was just that it didn't start until... until the August. That's possibly the best situation that you can have, I think, where you have some time off, but you know that it has an end.
When you started, was there sort of a cohort of people all starting at the same time as you?
Yes, approximately.
Okay.
There was a little bit of variation. I think there were people starting anywhere from about June to October, November, and it depended both on your own circumstances, but also on the office that you were coming into and the person that you were going to be working with.
When you started working as a trainee, you say the person that you're going to be working with, so you had a mentor, sort of?
Like a supervisor.
A supervisor.
Yeah,
okay.
It's quite...
And so you were working fairly closely with that person?
Very closely. It was almost like an apprenticeship type situation,
yeah,
where they were really in charge of the work that I was given, and also reviewing the work that I'd done and teaching me things.
So that person was a patent attorney who had a fair amount of experience and was helping to sort of orient. I mean, it's a big change.
It really was, yes. When I was an undergraduate and a postgraduate, I was very motivated by staying in research, not necessarily in exactly the field that I was in, but that I would be doing a research job. As I went on, I was discovering that many of the things that I really enjoyed were not really the core bits of the research and development that I was doing, and I thought it might be time to rethink. There was a bit of serendipity in that a trainee patent attorney position came up in Edinburgh. There's not that many trainee positions in Scotland. And I thought, well, if I'm ever going to do this, this is probably something that I should find out more about now.
Mm-hmm.
But having seen this particular position at Marks & Clark made me think I am going to have to do my homework straight away and decide whether this is something I'm interested in. This was actually the only firm that I applied to.
Yeah.
I think having found out more about the job, because I had some great conversations with people... Actually, at Marks & Clark, as it happened, there was an attorney in the Glasgow office who talked to me about the career, and also a trainee in one of our English offices who had been at Kinetic at the same time that I was at Kinetic and could really give me a side-by-side comparison of the jobs. That was incredibly useful.
Was there a job advert and you saw that there was a closing date and that was kind of what motivated you to...
Absolutely. That made me realise there was a timeline. I do better with deadlines. That gave me an incentive to really get on with it. I was lucky that St Andrew's Careers Department will still offer you careers advice even if you've been away from St Andrew's for, I think I'd been away for 12 or 13 years at that point, but they were still willing to help me, and that was actually really useful because they could give me some advice on how to tailor my CV and cover letter for this new field that I hadn't been in before.
So it sounds like you were fairly confident that at that point you wanted to become a patent attorney. You didn't just say to yourself, well, I'll try this, and if it doesn't work, I'll move on. It sounds like there was that fairly high level of commitment when you started.
I don't know. I think that I could still have ended up somewhere else. I think the same week I interviewed for Martin Clark, I had an interview for a renewable energy job. I don't know. I don't think it's inevitable that I ended up in this.
Once you started, I'm sort of wondering, because you had developed a range of skills for antennas, and you had to work on different skills when you started working on patents. And I'm wondering if that was frustrating. Sometimes starting a new thing can just be sort of a relief, and you think, yeah, I've wanted to do this, or this is something that's been missing. And sometimes you can sort of feel like, well, but I've already done these, there are these other pathways that I've walked a fair way down that trail already, and now I'm starting. Sometimes it feels like starting over, but I'm wondering if it felt that way when you started.
I think certainly once I've started, I probably don't want to do anything else now in terms of another career. I think this is the last start. It was a big commitment. It was good to have a bit of time to think about this decision because it was going to be a big change. I knew to expect that I would know nothing when I started in terms of the legal aspect. That is really normal. That is exactly how patent attorney firms will hire people. They want people who have the scientific or technical background, and they know that they can teach patent law on top of that. So the patent law aspects were new, but the technical aspects were interesting and fun and always different, because working for lots of different clients in different technical areas is quite exciting. And because I'd always enjoyed that learning phase, and that I get to learn things all the time, both on the technical side and on the law side, it's quite a fun process. What I appreciated about starting in this job and this career was I felt the approach to training was very structured, not necessarily in the terms of having loads of lectures, and though we do now have quite a structured process with our training academy, which started after I'd already started. But it was understood that everything I was learning on the law side, I would need to learn really thoroughly and really well. It's not just a case of, reading something or kind of messing about with a model and getting to know it and learning things as you go. Everything has to be legally correct.
Very rigorous.
It's rigorous, yeah.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that, because it means if everything was coming back at the start, I would write a really short letter, it would come back with loads of red pen. But then once it started coming back with less red pen, I thought, oh, okay, I kind of know that I'm doing okay here. I am actually improving. Whereas in some things I've done previously, it would be harder to... It was a lot less explicit in the way it was structured in training me and making sure that I was becoming more and more competent in the area I was working in. I think it's because it's such a big change to learn the law. I think in some other jobs you can kind of assume that, oh well, they've got a physics degree, they'll probably figure it out. Here it's understood that we don't know any law coming in, and we really have to be taught that. And that's quite pleasant. That's good. That's good to know. It feels like there's firm foundations to the training and how it developed.
But what about other people starting at the same time? When you were going through training, did you work with them at all? Did you discuss issues together? And was that formal or informal?
There were two people who started at a similar time to me in our Glasgow office. And so that was a really good resource. We did a university course in Bournemouth, which is one possible way of getting your initial qualifications. It's not the one that Martin Clark now uses, but at the time, it was what the Scottish trainees were doing. And so that was great because we got to know each other well on the weekends that we were in Bournemouth for that course. And we could always kind of call each other up or text each other. We were going through similar things at the same time. So that was really useful. As I have progressed, I've got to know people at a similar stage to me in others of our UK offices. And that's also been really good. And also trainees at other firms as well.
So just because I don't know, where are the offices for Marks and Clerk? There's Glasgow and there's Edinburgh, and where are the other ones?
Aberdeen, Birmingham, Manchester, Oxford, Cambridge, London, Luxembourg, two in France, Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, Beijing, and two in Canada. I might have missed one or two.
So there are quite a few, but it sounds like it's mostly in the UK.
The UK is the original location, and in practice my contact with other offices and other trainees is mostly within the UK offices. So there's eight.
I'm wondering about this process for you. So you were working as a trainee and you were studying to become an attorney at the same time, and so I'm wondering how you divided your time between working and studying.
That's a really key thing in training as a patent attorney. In a way, the most important part of the training is the on-the-job training that you have with your supervisor, and how they're marking up your work products that you've done, and giving you real-time feedback and talking you through the legal issues that occur in the various tasks that we're doing for clients. But there is also this formal part of the training where you have to... There's a lot of exams that you definitely have to do, but the first stage of exams can either be done by a university course with an exam at the end, or by a set of a few exams. And in my case, it was the university course. It was really hard to balance in the first year when I was doing that university course. I probably put more time in the university course than I needed to. And for my later exams, I was much more focused on having some balance and limiting the time that I was spending on the studying to what I thought I could reasonably get away with not trying. On the first university course, I came away with a distinction. I was very pleased with myself. In retrospect, I should have aimed to pass with 51%. That would have been a better balance. So that I learned a lot with that first course that fed into how I studied later on, that I needed to have days when I didn't work, because the job is a full-time job. It was 9 to 5, but then I was having to put in extra hours for the training.
That first set of exams and first course that you took, it sounds like you maybe kind of overdid it a bit, that you really extended yourself. And so at that time, I'm guessing you would then in the evenings and weekends you'd be working on the coursework. How much time outside of working hours would you say that involved?
I think the course recommended that it was 12 to 15 hours. Yeah, I was probably doing at least the 15 hours, but too much for me personally.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
When you cut it down and found the manageable amount, what did you...
A manageable amount for me is about an hour per day on the working day, and then a half day on a Saturday morning. So that would be, 9 hours, something like that?
Yeah.
That's a sustainable amount for me. Studying for exams is not the whole time that you're training. There are kind of exam seasons. Some years that you're doing exams, sometimes you're not. Some years that you're doing two sets of exams, so that feels fairly relentless. But so there'll be a few months in the run-up to an exam when you're studying. An advantage of exams over university course is that you can decide to start studying early and do less per week, or you can study later and do more per week. In a way, a fixed exam on a fixed date can be more flexible in how you study for it than actually taking a course where it requires you to put in homeworks every week. I thought the university course was... a good way of structuring it because it does kind of break things down and have intermediate. We had to submit essays and things like that. But actually, I think sometimes the exam way of doing it is not a bad thing, as it gives you a lot more freedom over your study schedule.
Not to focus on negative things. Oh. Were there any exams that you didn't pass?
Yeah.
And so how did that feel? It's just sort of considered, yeah, that's going to happen sometimes.
That's normal. Yeah. So I think the second interview I had for this job, I felt like a lot of what they were saying to me was, this is going to be really hard and you're going to fail exams and you won't have failed exams before, and except maybe a driving test. And I thought, oh, hi, you've met me. I did indeed fail my driving test. But that was an expected part, and not to be too concerned in that it wouldn't really affect my progression as such, or maybe I wouldn't qualify as quickly, but nobody's going to throw you out because you didn't pass an exam. You know, it's really normal. I failed a couple on the way through, but it takes months for the results to come in, so you're sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, your October exam, the results come out in like February or March. That's a bit grim.
And let's say you've failed that exam, so that means you're going to have to retake that section before you move on. I'm guessing that it's sequential.
The ones that I failed, I was quite lucky because they're the only ones that you can get an exemption from by doing other exams. So in fact, I've never passed them. So we qualify on a set of exams that are specific to the UK to become a chartered patent attorney in the UK. And then there's another set of exams to become a European patent attorney. And there are a couple of the European exams that if you pass them, you get an exemption from the corresponding UK exam. And I gladly took the exemption and didn't resit the UK exams. Most of the exams you would have to reset.
In becoming a patent attorney in the UK, is it a given that you're going to become a European patent attorney at the same time?
You need the European one. The European qualification is a really useful qualification because then you can work anywhere within Europe, which is not just the EU, there's other non-EU countries that are part of the European Patent Convention, so and that's really the most important one. There are others, for example, people who go to our Singapore office. The Singapore patent system uses almost the same exams, so you only have to sit like one extra exam to become qualified in Singapore. Some other countries have really significant differences in law. So, for example, if you wanted to move eventually to like Australia or New Zealand, their patent law is quite similar, but the US has a very different system, and US patent attorneys have to have a full-on law qualification, like a JD, whereas UK or European patent attorneys don't have to have a law degree.
Eventually, you take... I don't know if there is a big final exam. There are many exams all the way through.
There are lots of exams. Yeah. There's like 4 European final exams and 4 UK final exams. So.
And so these final exams, is it like one day after another, or they're spread out over a few months, kind of? How does that...
They all happen in the same week. I split them, though. You don't have to sit them all in the same sitting.
Okay.
I split them across different years. The UK exams are in October, so I did 2 in one October and 2 in the following October. Similarly, the European exams are in February or March, so I did 2 in one year and 2 the following year. I'm really happy with that decision. It also made a lot more sense in the terms of just having a bit of a life. But different people have different strategies for that. Some people just want to go and give everything a go as soon as they can, and if they get through them, then great. There's no one way to do it. In practice, the firms were quite flexible about trusting people to sit exams in a way that's sensible to them.
How long between when you started as a trainee to that final exam?
It was 5 years to get qualified. So I had the university course in the first year. I didn't sit any exams in the second year. In the third year, I had European pre-exam, and I must have started UK's sometime about there. So my final exams were in the February, and I got the results in the July, which was nearly, so like 4 years and 11 months after I'd started.
Yeah. For example, when people get their PhD, one place that I went, there was this really nice restaurant in town, it was kind of this myth. You're going to get your PhD and you're going to go eat in that restaurant. It's going to be like this wonderful celebration. Was there anything like that?
It's really strange because the results come such a long time after you've done the exams. So that's really odd, but I did go to the pub with some friends and
that's good.
Nice to, it's really strange because in a way it's achieving something, but then it's also just the start of being able to work more independently. So
these exams that you set, how long were they, the final ones? You said there were 4 for the UK and 4 for Europe. And each one, did it last 2 hours, or how long was that?
Oh, no, like, 3 or 4 or 5 or...
They're really long.
Yeah, they're really long. We're not used to writing by hand anymore, but they do actually recommend that you start writing a whole load of things by hand in the weeks or months that you're coming out to build out your muscles. Yeah, exactly. They're much worse than university exams for me personally anyway, so...
Once those were finished, did it just really change things for you? So you'd come into work and your work day was very different as a result of that?
It was a kind of gradual transition. So I'd always been, the core type of work didn't really change. I'm still meeting inventors and finding out about their inventions and writing patent applications for them and writing communications to the patent office. Definitely the level of supervision had tailed off towards the end of my training period anyway. But it was a difference being able to actually sign things off myself. I think the biggest difference was kind of in the various kind of administrative aspects of actually being responsible for deadlines and having a lot more visibility, all the different tasks that are coming up on the different work that I'm doing for different clients. Before I qualified, I was seeing a bit of that, but to an extent I was relying on my supervisor to hand me work tasks and also to kind of be the one who was really responsible for making sure that things were done by the deadline. You know, I'd be aware of when the deadlines were and I'd be doing my part, but it wasn't quite that full responsibility of saying, right, well, these are really mine. I do still do a lot of work that comes through my supervisor, though. I still work on a lot of work for the same clients that I was working on before. It's just I'll maybe have more direct contact with them and a higher level of responsibility, starting to get a few of my own smaller clients and also do some work for other people who are not the person I trained with. It's been a gradual transition.
In all careers, you have a set of skills that you're using, but it seems like in some careers, maybe there's one skill that's really dominant. So for example, if you had stayed in physics and done physics research, I know that there's still a range of skills that those people use. They're not, but it seems like it's very much a dominant skill, the physics, I don't know if you'd say physics research. But it seems to me that with being a patent attorney, it isn't as dominated by one skill. It's kind of this combination of skills. Mm. Like, you need to have the very technical skills, but they're technical skills in science as well as technical skills in terms of your writing. And it's about kind of matching your skills to the skills of the position. Is this a better match for you? And do you see it that way, that there are these two dominating skills, it's not just one?
Yes, it's great. It's much better for me. I do see it as a really good match. The core skill is really one of communication and analysis, whether that's most often written communication and analysis, writing and reading, reading technical documents, analysing them, making arguments to the patent office, or telling the patent office why your client should be granted an invention. So really caring about words and how they're interpreted and being able to pick through them and compare them and say, well, you said these two documents are the same, they're actually not the same, and this is the reason, being able to construct that argument. But you wouldn't be able to do that writing and reading and analysis if you didn't already know something about physics.
Yeah.
Because the subject matter just wouldn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It's a really great way to apply that background that I've got. Often things that came back from undergrad, I graduated 20 years ago, so sometimes that really feels like dredging things out, thank goodness for Wikipedia. You know, when I get something in a really different subject matter of physics, I'm going in and having to go, right, I'm going to need to give myself a quick refresher on this before I go and talk to the client so I can talk sensibly and understand the language that they're talking in. And, you know, we can start from a good starting point where they can then explain what's different about their invention. and we're not having to cover the basics. I'm having to get myself up to speak. But the fact that I did see it sometime before or something similar, or I kind of know how that maths worked, or I have an idea how, you know, a computer system would work or a laser would work. You know, I'm always using that core knowledge and then applying it to the specific things that I'm analysing or writing. So it's a really great combination. And the legal knowledge just feeds into everything as well. You learn it in theory for the exams. Although, saying that, the later exams are actually quite practical. They're supposed to simulate the sort of tasks you'd be doing in practice. Doing it in practice is quite a different thing. So the legal aspects just feed into everything as well. There's the technical aspects all feeding in, and then they're all brought together by the writing and reading and analysis. So it's a really fun combination.
So I'm wondering about these exams. Do you feel that going through them, that you use that knowledge all the time, that those are skills that you're constantly using?
Yes, the earlier exams are more general and cover trademarks and designs and copyright and general law, as well as patents. So there can be things you use less day to day there, and it's more about retaining a general awareness rather than necessarily retaining things that you've memorised. But the final exams are definitely useful. I did find the memorising very difficult. For the UK exams are closed book, so you do have to memorise. I found that extremely difficult. I found the European exams really useful because they're open book, and so you have to get the skill of finding where you'd find the answer. And so that's great. If you come across something that you don't do every day, you can go, oh, I know I did that for my exams. You know how to navigate around various documents, the European Patent Office's guidelines and all the other different legal documents that you've got. So I think that was actually enormously useful.
Now that you've passed those exams and you are a full patent attorney, what are your hours like now? So is it mostly kind of a 9-to-5 type working pattern?
I usually work a little bit longer than 9-to-5. Occasionally I might be coming up to a deadline and work a little bit later, but it's not, it would be extremely rare for me to be here on the weekend. It's a lot more of a standard job hours now that I'm not studying. I don't travel much. I really appreciate that in this job. It always seems like business travel is a fun thing. To me, it's not a fun thing at all. I don't do well with jet lag.
I guess I'm wondering what you like best about your position now. If you think about your week or a month time scale, what are the things that you look forward to coming in to work for, or that you look forward to doing when you come in?
There are sometimes just some technologies or tasks that they just feel really fun. I do really enjoy medical imaging work. I've worked for one client in medical imaging for basically the whole time that I've been working at Marks & Clark in the last 7 years. It can be really fun just to be going to a meeting with them, catching up, and then writing a new patent application that maybe is quite related to a bunch that I've done before. And it's also really rewarding when I'm often now seeing patent applications that I originally drafted several years ago, and they can be coming towards the stage where they're being granted. I maybe seeing something come in and go, oh, I think I can get this granted with the next response, and that can be quite satisfying. You know, the flip side of that is sometimes there's tasks that are just really, really difficult. I think a really good thing for me in this job, though, is that everything, whether it's good or bad, it goes by quite quickly. The tasks are all, they take days, or I mean maybe weeks at most, but more likely days. I'll maybe be in a week, I have several different things, or even in a day I'll be looking at, well, the normal thing of any job where you go, I'll need to respond to some emails, but I have a couple of tasks. Maybe I'm going to work on this one in the morning, I'm going to work on this one in the afternoon. So even if I've got a task that isn't so fun, I can usually balance that up with something that's more enjoyable.
So if we compare this position to when you were working in telecommunications or in defence, would you say part of what makes this more satisfying is the variety of different subjects that's being investigated, and maybe also the timescale?
Yes, 100%. I find this rhythm of work works way better for me. There's some ways that it's a little bit like being an undergraduate, and I really enjoy being an undergraduate because you're always doing different subject matter. And I mean, even within work for one client, it can be quite different things that they're trying to protect. You still get a different spin on something. So there's always something a bit different. There's always something to learn. The time skills are way better for me. I'm not very proud that it takes external deadlines to get me to really focus on something, but the presence of external deadlines is actually really helpful. We have an electronic deadline system, and I can just look and say, right, well, these are the things I've got to do for the week, and then try to structure it. As I say, maybe balance. If I've got something I'm really not looking forward to, I'll schedule something more fun for afterwards. Sometimes you get absolutely up to the wire and have to do the one thing that you're not wanting to do and get on with it, but at least then you do it and it's done, and you know that it has to have a day that it's got to be out of the door, because a lot of the deadlines that we're working to are absolutely fixed legal deadlines. You might manage to extend them. In some cases you can extend them once or twice, but you absolutely can't keep extending them forever. You've just got to get it done and get something in.
It sounds like with this, there's a lot of learning going on all the time, and I'm guessing that a lot of that is self-managed, but are there also formal parts to that learning?
I would make a distinction between the technical learning and the legal learning. From the legal side, we do have continuous professional development, going to talks or lectures, various different things. You can also do professional development by teaching other people. So there's that requirement. So we do have a set number of hours per year that we have to spend on that. On the technical side, the inventor is always the expert on their technology. So a lot of the meetings that we have with inventors, they're effectively teaching us about what it is that they do. I would say that if I'm going into a meeting with an inventor on a technology I'm not familiar with, I will do some reading just online, just be speaking the language a little bit and understand the basics in that field. So that's informal. It doesn't have to be perfect if the inventor is then going to give me the proper explanation. It just has to be enough to be able to ask questions that make sense.
You're talking about the legal professional development, and you say, well, we have to do a certain number of hours. Is that something that Marks and Clerk wants you to do, or is that in order to maintain your status as a patent attorney?
Yes, the latter. It is a requirement of a regulator, yeah.
Now that you've gotten to this point in your career, do you feel a sense that you are content? Do you feel there are still these goals out there where you think, yeah, I'm quite happy with this, but there's this other thing I still want to do, or maybe just aspects of this job that you're looking towards that you'd like to do?
So I'm 2 years qualified now, and I still feel pretty happy to qualify.
Yeah.
And like, I'm just learning lots of new things day to day still, and that's a really good position to be in. So whatever happens next, it's not like I need to jump about between jobs to get new things, because there's always going to be new clients, and the existing clients are going to want different things.
Yeah.
And the law changes a bit and things still progress. It's not a static job, and I'm still learning about specific areas as well, both technically and legally. So that's great. I mean, there are options for progression, and the next step would be senior associate, which is just kind of a step of doing similar things but being even more independent and responsible for your own areas and becoming a real expert in some of the areas that you're working in. And then from there, there's either principal associate or becoming a partner in the firm.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add or share?
I will just do the plug for Marks and Clerk Careers. We do hire on a cycle, and applications for this year, well, the date hasn't come out yet, but it's probably November, December sort of time that we accept applications and then interviews in the new year. The place to find about careers at Marks & Clerk is on our website. If you go to careers and then training to be a patent attorney, we are currently hiring for Singapore as well. There will be a cohort of people starting in the UK, which will be kind of September-ish next year. And that happens every year. It's similar sort of hiring at the end of the year. We do now have our training academy, which is
a training programme that's across all the offices in the UK. So you go around the different offices for occasional away days. You get to know everybody that it started at the same time as you. So I think it's about kind of 12, 15 people, which is great to have all those contacts in other offices. And there's some structured lectures, which are done by people all across the firm, which is great. The other thing I would flag up is for general information about careers in IP. There's a site, careersinideas.org.uk, which includes not just patent attorney, but also trademark attorney, paralegals, solicitors, working at the patent office, all sorts of different IP jobs. So that's got a lot of information.
In terms of applying at Marks & Clerk, there's a written application. And then if that is successful, there would be an interview, I'm guessing, that they would go through?
Yes, the application is just a CV and cover letter. I would say really get people to proofread your CV and cover letter in lots of detail, because we're looking for someone who's really quite meticulous about the writing.
And when you submitted I'm guessing you went through that process, you submitted your CV and a cover letter, and you had someone at St. Andrews read through that.
Yes, I can't remember exactly the process I went through with St. Andrews, but they did give me a steer, and especially they emphasised, on my year off, I'd been doing a lot of writing kind of poetry and fiction and performing poetry and blogging a lot. And they were like, no, you need to say that you write. And I had not, because I was used to engineering CVs, I hadn't thought of putting that in. And they were really like, no, that's exactly the sort of thing that can be really useful just to show that you care about writing, and writing and reading all day is not something that's going to put you off. You're not someone who would really rather be in the lab.
So that CV and cover letter, that's a critical.
It is really important, especially the cover letter. A lot of what you're going to be doing is writing legal letters. Mm-hmm. So saying that, sometimes people think that they have to be really, really formal. Well, both in the legal letters and in the CV cover letter. It's not necessarily the case that you have to use lots of long words. We do really rate communication that's clear and direct. Having something that expresses what you want to say, not in a very flowery way, but in quite a direct way, can be a useful communication style.
Thank you for speaking with me today.